You can have a seat. As we find our way to Matthew chapter 16, we have this really crucial turning point in the entire book of Matthew. Just a foundational passage and teaching for all of our Christian faith. So Matthew, up until this point, has largely been about the ministry of Jesus. We've seen Jesus teaching, we've seen Jesus healing and having compassion on others, and all that kind of image comes. And now in this passage, about midway through chapter 16, we see this huge shift from a focus on Jesus as a teacher, as a prophet, as a miracle worker, to a focus on a Jesus who is headed toward death. And this death of Jesus Christ, this impending death, and what that means for him and for all of his followers, is what all the rest of those passages are about, all the rest of those chapters. And so we're making a big shift, obviously headed toward Palm Sunday, headed toward Good Friday, headed toward Easter. That shift has been made really, really clear for us here. From a Jesus who speaks about miracles to this Jesus who speaks about his own death. From talking about our faith to how we live out that relationship with him. Jesus, in the beginning of this section here, is on his way to this town called Caesarea Philippi. Maybe going there by boat. It was on the Sea of Galilee, so it's pretty easy to get there. And they had this huge rock wall right beside the city that was kind of pockmarked by all these little niches within it. And so one of those, it was larger, was placed, and it's, maybe the grotto is an image for you. Have you ever been to the grotto before? So it's this big kind of rock structure, and then there's a couple niches in there that little statues and candles and other stuff are put in there. So imagine something like that, probably a little bit bigger than that. And so one of those larger niches has a temple for Caesar in there. One of them has a temple to Pan. And then it's almost every little niche somewhere in there has another god stuffed in it with candles around it or prayers stuffed around it and whatever else it can. So there's this whole kind of wall of gods, really. Right, that's right there on the side of the city as they're coming in there. And so maybe that was what Jesus led him to kind of ask that question. Maybe it wasn't, but at least it was a part of the setting around there. When Jesus says, you know, I wonder who people think I am. Now, I mean, here's this range of all these gods that are out there, of all these religious figures you can follow, of all these different ways of running after the spiritual in your life. And he asked that profound question in verse 13, who is it that people say that I am? And for all the things that Jesus gets knocked for, he certainly isn't forgotten. Even in a place like Oregon, where few people attend church on a Sunday morning, the vast majority of our neighbors and coworkers have found something else to do this morning. They still pretty much all have heard of Jesus. They pretty much all have some awareness of who he is. You can go into the farthest reaches in some places around the world, and there's still the name is there to some degree. So what I would love for you to do for a moment is to think, what is it that I hear from those that are not in a church setting? Like, if I were to ask my neighbors, if I were to hear them honestly say, this is what I think about Jesus, this is what I think about who he is. Can you just turn to someone around you and say, here's what I've heard people say, what I imagine they would say, what I've heard from TV or what or movies or whatever they've communicated. What are the rumors going on about who Jesus is? Can you just turn to someone and share that briefly? What are some things that you've said? Anyone want to throw some ideas out there? He's a good man. Yeah. Okay. What else do we hear said about Jesus? He's a prophet or a teacher. Yeah. Only one way? One of many ways. Yeah. So one prophet among many prophets, one teacher among many teachers, one good man among many men. What's strange to me, or fascinating, is that the answers that we compile are really the same ones that Peter shared then too. He has a little bit more of a Jewish bent because he names a couple Jewish prophets. But to a large degree, the idea is the same. Here is someone who obviously is steeped in a spiritual connection. Obviously, there is wisdom about this person. There is a goodness about this person, right? I mean, no one is accusing him of being a lecher, of being greedy, of being all about money, of being angry, of being violent, of being like any of those kinds of things. Like, we see this quality individual who has this kind of leadership spiritually for us. So the same kind of ideas about Jesus floated in that day and age that float around in our day and age. But then Jesus has a follow-up question, which he's so good at doing. And he says, I wonder who it is that you think that I am. Now, obviously, Peter gives an answer. You've probably heard it read many times before. I don't want you to worry about that one right now. What I would love for you to do is just on your own, don't worry about anyone else. And don't borrow words from Scripture or just repeat those, but can you just come to Jesus right now and say, this is who I see you to be. Just on your own, in your own heart. When Steve shared, he did a good job of kind of communicating the lostness or confused nature of the disciples, how they've followed Jesus for over a year now, and they still can't seem to put all the pieces together. And so we have this one little brief moment where Peter seems to finally get the pieces together, and then in a couple verses he'll drift off again before long. So there's this little glimmer of hope. And that is the answer that he gives. He says, well, you're the Messiah. You're this one promised through all of our Jewish scriptures. And you are the Son of the very living God. And how does Jesus respond to that? He says, you're right. All these others didn't have the right understanding of who I am. They have a glimmer, a little piece of those kinds of things. The answer that you gave is absolutely right and correct. It is the creed, it is the truth, it is the teaching of God that we have. So see if you can go on to the next one there, right? Here is a statement that is absolutely true about the nature and the identity of Jesus. And he goes on to say, hey, you're going to be the rock that I'm going to build my church on. It's going to conquer all the realms of Satan around. This great, beautiful promise that comes out of that. But then we move on and realize that it's not complete. Right, there's this really, really rich understanding that simply intellectually affirming truth about the nature of God is not the end of the process. You see, what's so enticing about Jesus being a prophet, what draws people so much to that, is that you can honor him and not have to listen. If somebody is a wise man or a prophet or a good teacher or a good man, you can respect them. And if there's something you like, you can take it into yourself. And if there's something you don't, you're like, well, I mean, no prophet has it all, right? I still got to find my own way and my own path. So there's a lot of things to like about finding prophets, because we can still have our own authority on those kinds of things. When Jesus becomes God, then all those things drift away. You don't get to pick and choose what you like. You don't get to disagree with God. You don't get to say your way is wrong and my way is right, because he's God. And so a lot of our freedom is removed. A lot of our own ego and hope and ourselves is gone. And what Peter fails to do is to realize the implications. He gives the right answer, but fails to realize that if that's the right answer, then obedience must follow. Right, there's no way for Jesus to be the Messiah, the Son of the living God, and not follow from that a life response. It says, I need to then be obedient, I need to listen, I need to follow after you. Those things are twin priorities for us, and we reflect that in our worship setting. Right, we have the Bible kind of written out on that scroll over there, which is the creed in a larger sense, right? It's all this truth that we have about God. But if all that we have is that, then we're just where Peter is. And we maybe have a right answer. We can get the quiz correct and all those things. But we fail on that next stage to know, what does this mean in my life? Where do I go? And so we have what we call the coaster over there, which fills in the rest of where Jesus goes. This is a life of truth needs to be matched by a life of truth. Right? Having the right ideas needs to have the right life that flows out of those things, that comes from us as well. Peter gets stuck in that middle ground, wants to have the right answer, but then still wants to be the one in authority. And so we see what it looks like to try to lead Jesus in verse 22. Verse 21, Jesus is as clear as anything, well before it happens, that I will suffer from the elders, the chief priests, the teachers of the law. I will be killed, and on the third day I will be raised from the dead. Right? It's absolutely as clear as anything can possibly be. And Peter's response is a response of leading Jesus, not of following, right? He says, I want you to still be that prophet so I can correct you. He says, no, that's not how it works. If you really are the Messiah, the Son of God, then you're one of power, one of authority. Nobody's going to kill you. Nobody's going to attack you. You're not going to suffer. That's not a part of what that story is. And that's a response that's pretty familiar to all of us. We often try to lead God. And when God speaks into our lives, we come back, and Steve reflected on that in his story too, how many times he comes back and says, I want this to be my own path. I want this to be out of me. God, this can't be of you. I have a business meeting to get to. Right? We all have those moments in our life. Well, God, this isn't your will for my life. This isn't what you want for me. I'm sure it must be something better. It must be something easier. The path cannot be this hard. And we want to come back and change that direction from God. We want to be the one that leads and directs where he goes. And God, or Jesus, offers this stern rebuke to Peter. He says, get behind me, Satan. You don't get to lead anymore. That's the revelation that comes. And it took all those times of those miracles and the teaching building up to this moment where Jesus can say, this is what it means for me to have authority in this world. That you follow me. Not that you lead me. And following Jesus in verse 24 is pretty clear, although difficult for us, right? Deny yourself, take up your cross, and follow me. It says that if I find Jesus there, then I'm willing to go there and willing to embrace and walk in those places. It is a challenging call for us. Maybe more than we even realize. I want to reflect a little bit on what it means to take up our cross. To bear our cross. That's maybe a popular phrase that we use in religious circles. We talk about having to bear our cross, or this is the cross that I have to bear, etc. I think that often, at least as I've heard that reflected on, we get that wrong, and we apply it to the wrong thing. And so I just want to clarify that a bit for us this morning. If you look at what Jesus is saying in that verse, he says that ties that the bearing of the cross into this denying of what? Yourself. Now, denial is an action that you are taking, and it is toward yourself. The bearing up is an action that you are taking. So core to the idea of what it is when you bear a cross is this is something you are choosing. Something you're freely saying, no one's forcing me, no one's pressing this upon me, I am choosing of myself to deny myself here. I'm choosing on my own to pick this thing up and put it on my back and to carry it in my life. A lot of time when I hear about bearing cross, it are things that we, first of all, have no choice over. Right here is an illness that's in my life, and that's the cross that I need to bear. Here's a weakness in my body, that's the cross that I need to bear. Here's a difficult job situation. Here's the loss of a job that I face. Financial difficulties is the cross that I need to bear. Here is this challenging relationship, a thankless spouse, a child who's wandered off from the faith or has pierced your heart with a lot of grief from choices that they've made. Here is the cross that I need to bear. I want to be really clear right now that all of those things are real. All of those things are things that God desperately cares about. That he yearns to heal and to restore in the work of his kingdom. Right? So none of that is wrong. He invites us to persevere in that, and he invites us to pray and to say, God, will you restore these things out of me? But those are not biblically what it means to deny yourself and take up a cross, because you're not choosing that. Hands down, when we face those kinds of things, we pray the other direction. We say, God, I would like health. I would like financial stability. I would like this relationship healed or restored or met. And again, that is good. It is gracious. It is of God. I don't want to take anything away from that. Don't hear that any of that is wrong. But just recognize that's not what the verse speaks of. The verse speaks about something that you freely say, I take this on myself. So if you've chosen a vow of poverty, or a vow of saying, I am going to give 10% or 20% or more or whatever it is, and because of that you face difficulties, that then becomes a cross, because you have chosen it. If your boss removes your job for you, if you're not paid what you deserve, if you take some financial risks and they don't turn out well for you, that's not the cross you have to bear. That's the challenges that we all face in life, right? That's a universal human experience. And it differs based on who we are. But this is speaking about a specifically Christian experience. And so we live in our humanity before a God who comes in mercy for us, and we cry out to Him out of that. But this passage speaks then about a specifically Christian experience for someone who is choosing to be a disciple. So it's not a part of the life of anyone who isn't, that says, I take into my life a difficulty, a challenge, a sacrifice, because I want to be close to Jesus. Because I want to be near to Him. And so that cross is a secondary truth then, is one that is born for Jesus. Not one that we're seeking to get rid of in our life, one that we welcome and we say, I'm happy for that to exist within my life, although it costs me, although it challenges me, although there is a price to be paid, but I do it for the glory of Jesus. I do it for the honor of Jesus Christ. I do it because I love Him with all of my heart. And the greatest value that I have is to be close to where He is. This is the invitation from God. He says, this is what it's like, Peter. Because Peter wanted this God of all that glory that didn't cost anything from him, that only gave things. And here Jesus comes back and says, I'm asking you to find things in your life that are good and rich and valuable, and to release those to me. I'm asking you to take on others' burdens and others' challenges, so that greater good might come out of that. It is the invitation from Jesus, not merely to participate in Easter. Not merely to say, God, I want to be there when you're resurrected from the dead, but to say, I am willing to participate in the cross too. And there is, it's a helpful metaphor for you to use as you interact with larger Christianity, as you interact, and we're exposed to a lot of different Christian teachers, right? And we get that on the radio, on TV, from books, etc. So there's kind of these two basic ways of understanding. Either there is a theology of the cross or a theology of glory. The theology of the cross says that we embrace both the crucifixion and the resurrection of Jesus. A theology of glory says, I want to have the cross be Jesus, and then I want to jump into the resurrection part and enjoy that part of things. That's not what we understand biblically, where He invites us to say, I want you to be a participant in all of my life, which includes my sacrifice as well as my glory that comes after. So that's a theological point for you. What I want to invite you to do right now is just to go ahead and search in your life. And maybe lay aside the things, and not even lay aside, just honestly lay before God. Like, here are the pains of my life. Here are the challenges and the illnesses and the brokenness that intersects with me as a human being that I yearn to be free for, and I need your healing and hope for. He wants to hear that too. But then when you've done that, to take a moment and say, God, is there anywhere that I have freely chosen a burden for your sake? I hope that that's not too crushing, because as I look at all of you, I can, for many of you, say yes to that, and I can fill in some of those blanks. That doesn't mean that you've done everything, but I want you to see where that is. When you choose to sacrifice, when you choose to take your time out to prepare those things, when you choose to serve others on behalf of Jesus Christ, that's a cross. But that's what it means. Here's my free time that I give up so that I can prepare for the worship team, so I can prepare to speak, so that I can work with the children somewhere, I can work with foster kids or with refugees or wherever else it is, or not even in a technical ministry, but just with someone that I know that's in need around me, etc. Right? That is what it means. I'm freely doing that for the sake of Jesus Christ. So lay what other wounds you have before, and then can you in your heart just say, where has that shown up in my life already? Jesus, as I search my own heart, I find something interesting. Words of denial and cross are not very attractive to me. But when I kind of boil down to those places that I have freely given things up for you, what I find are honestly some of the best moments in my life and some of the brightest memories that I have. And I find something beautiful in that. And so, God, maybe that's even just a little encouragement for us, that you're not a fool, that you do know what you're doing, and that following you might actually be a vastly better path than following ourselves. That walking this road of a cross might actually be the very best life we could ever lead. So God, I pray just against that spirit of condemnation that always wants to weasel its way in there. This is not a condemnation from you about where we failed. This is an invitation. An invitation from the Messiah, the Son of the living God. It says, come and follow me. I pray, Jesus, that we will find ourselves as we find you. Amen.